The Trial by Franz Kafka Continued, Disc 3.
They made a very modest impression. Spaced out at nearly regular intervals, they sat in two rows on long wooden benches situated on both sides of the hallway. All of them were carelessly dressed, in spite of the fact that most, to judge by their expression, their posture, the style of their beards, and numerous other small details difficult to pin down, belonged to the upper classes. Since no coat hooks were available, they had placed their hats beneath the bench, probably following each other's lead. As those sitting closest to the door caught sight of Kay and the court usher, they rose in greeting. When those behind them noticed, they thought they had to do so as well, so that all of them rose as the two men passed by. They never straightened entirely. Backs bowed and knees bent, they stood like beggars in the street. Kay waited for the court usher, who was a few steps behind him, and said, "How humbled they must be." "Yes," said the court usher, "they're defendants. Everyone you see is a defendant." "Really?" said Kay. "Then they're my colleagues." And he turned to the closest one, a tall, slim man whose hair was already turning grey. "What is it you're waiting for?" Kay asked politely. The unexpected question, however, confused the man, which was even more embarrassing since he was obviously a man of the world, who would certainly have retained his self-confidence elsewhere, and did not easily relinquish the superiority he had attained over so many others. But here he couldn't even answer such a simple question, and looked at the others as if it were their duty to come to his aid, and as if no one could expect an answer from him if such aid were not forthcoming. Then the court usher stepped forward and said, trying to calm the man and lend him encouragement, "The gentleman is only asking what you're waiting for. Go ahead and answer." The no doubt familiar voice of the court usher was more effective. "I'm waiting," he began, and hesitated. He had apparently chosen this opening in order to answer the question exactly as it was posed, but could not think how to go on now. A few among those waiting had drawn near and gathered about them. The court usher said to them, get back, keep the hallway clear." They retreated somewhat, but did not return to their original places. In the meantime, the man who had been questioned had pulled himself together and even managed a faint smile as he answered. "A month ago I submitted several petitions to hear evidence in my case, and I'm waiting for them to be acted upon." "You seem to be taking great pains," said Kay. "Yes," said the man, "after all, it's my case." "Well, not everyone shares your view," said Kay. "For example, I'm a defendant too, but I'll be blessed if I've submitted a petition to hear evidence or done anything at all of that sort. Do you really think it's necessary?" "I'm not certain," said the man, once more completely unsure of himself. He apparently thought Kay was making fun of him and would have evidently preferred to repeat his earlier answer in full for fear of making some new mistake. But in the face of Kay's impatient gaze, he simply said, "For my part, I've submitted petitions to hear evidence." "You probably don't think I'm really a defendant," Kay said. "Oh yes, certainly," said the man, and stepped aside slightly, but anxiety, not belief, lay in his reply. "So you don't believe me?" asked Kay, seizing the man by the arm, unconsciously provoked by his humbleness, as if he wished to compel him to believe. He had no intention of hurting him, however, and squeezed quite gently. But even so the man screamed as if Kay had applied a pair of red-hot pincers and not merely two fingers. With this ridiculous outcry, Kay finally had enough of the man. If he didn't believe he was a defendant, so much the better. Perhaps he even took him for a judge. And now, in parting, he indeed squeezed him harder, pushed him back down onto the bench and walked on. "Most defendants are so sensitive," said the court usher. Behind them, almost all those who were waiting gathered around the man, who had already stopped screaming, apparently quizzing him closely about the incident. Kay was now approached by a guard, who could be recognized chiefly by a sabre whose scabbard, to judge by its color, was made of aluminum. Kay was amazed by this, and even reached out toward it. The guard, who had been drawn by the screams, asked what had happened. The court usher attempted to pacify him with a few words, but the guard said he'd have to look into it himself. Saluted and hurried on, taking extremely rapid but quite short steps, probably hindered by gout. Kay soon ceased worrying about him and the people in the hallway, particularly since he saw, about halfway down the hall, a turn to the right through an opening with no door. He checked with the court usher whether it was the right way. The court usher nodded, and Kay took the turn. It annoyed him that he always had to walk a pace or two ahead of the court usher, since, given the location, it might appear that he was an arrested man under escort. So he slowed up several times for the court usher, who, however, kept hanging back. Finally, to put an end to his discomfort, Kay said, "Well, I've seen what things look like here, and I'm ready to leave."
"You haven't seen everything yet," said the court usher, completely without guile.
"I don't want to see everything," said Kay, who was, in fact, feeling quite tired. "I want to leave. Where's the exit?"
"Well, surely you're not lost already," asked the court usher in amazement.
"You go to the corner there, turn right, go straight down the hall to the door."
"Come with me," said Kay. "Show me the way. I'll miss it. There are so many ways here."
"What's the only way?" said the court usher, reproachfully now. "I can't go back with you. I have to deliver my report, and I've already lost a good deal of time because of you."
"Come with me," Kay repeated more sharply, as if he had finally caught the court usher in a lie.
"Don't shout so," whispered the court usher. "There are offices all around here. If you don't want to go back by yourself, then come along with me a ways, or wait here until I've delivered my report. Then I'll gladly go back with you."
"No, no," said Kay. "I won't wait, and you have to go with me now." Kay hadn't even looked around the room he was in. Not until one of the many wooden doors surrounding him opened did he glance over. A young woman, no doubt drawn by Kay's loud voice, stepped in and asked,
"May I help you, sir?"
Behind her, in the distance, a man could be seen approaching in the semi-darkness. Kay looked at the court usher. After all, he'd said that no one would pay any attention to Kay, and now here came two people already. It wouldn't take much, and the official bureaucracy would notice him and demand an explanation for his presence. The only reasonable and acceptable one was that he was a defendant trying to discover the date of his next hearing. But that was precisely the explanation he didn't wish to give, particularly since it wasn't true, for he had come out of pure curiosity, or, even less acceptable as an explanation, out of a desire to confirm that the interior of this judicial system was just as repugnant as its exterior. And it seemed that he had been right in that assumption. He had no wish to intrude any further. He was inhibited enough by what he had already seen. And he was certainly in no mood now to confront some high official who might appear from behind any door. He wanted to leave, with the court usher or alone, if need be. But the way he was silently standing there must have been striking, and the young woman and the court usher were actually looking at him as if they thought he was about to undergo some profound metamorphosis at any moment, one they didn't want to miss. And in the doorway stood the man Kay had noticed in the background earlier, holding on tightly to the lintel of the low door and rocking back and forth slightly on the tips of his toes, like an impatient spectator. It was the young woman, however, who first realized that Kay's behavior was the result of a slight indisposition. She brought him a chair and asked,
"Wouldn't you like to sit down?"
Kay sat down immediately and propped his elbows on the arms of the chair for better support.
"You're a little dizzy, aren't you?"
she asked him. Her face was now quite near. It bore the severe expression some young women have precisely in the bloom of youth.
"Don't worry," she said. "There's nothing unusual about that here. Almost everyone has an attack like this the first time. You are here for the first time. Well, you see, then, it's nothing at all unusual. The sun beats down on the attic beams, and the hot wood makes the air terribly thick and stifling. That's why this isn't such a good location for the offices, in spite of the many other advantages it offers. But as far as the air is concerned, on days when the traffic of involved parties is heavy, you can hardly breathe, and that's almost daily. Then, if you take into consideration that a great deal of wash is hung out here to dry as well, the tenants can't be entirely forbidden from doing so, it will come as no surprise that you feel a little sick. But in the end, people get quite used to the air. When you come here the second or third time, you'll hardly notice the stuffiness at all. Do you feel better yet?"
Kay didn't reply. He was too embarrassed that this sudden weakness had placed him at these people's mercy. Moreover, now that he knew the cause of his nausea, he didn't feel better, but instead a little worse. The young woman noticed this right away, picked up a hooked pole leaning against the wall, and, to give Kay a little fresh air, pushed open a small hatch directly above Kay that led outside. But so much soot fell in that the young woman had to close the hatch again immediately and wipe the soot from Kay's hands with her handkerchief, since Kay was too tired to do it himself. He would gladly have remained sitting there quietly until he had gathered the strength to leave, and the less attention they paid to him, the sooner that would happen. But now the young woman added,
"You can't stay here. We're interrupting the flow of traffic."
Kay looked around to see what traffic he could possibly be interrupting.
"If you want, I'll take you to the infirmary." "Help me, please," she said to the man in the doorway, who approached at once. But Kay didn't want to go to the infirmary. That was precisely what he wanted to avoid, being led farther on. For the farther he went, the worse things would get. So he said, "I can walk now," and stood up shakily, spoiled by the comfort of sitting. But then he couldn't hold himself upright. "I can't do it," he said, shaking his head, and sat down again with a sigh. He remembered the court usher, who could easily lead him out in spite of everything, but he appeared to be long gone. Kay peered between the young woman and the man, who were standing in front of him, but couldn't find the court usher. "I believe," said the man, who was elegantly dressed with a striking grey waistcoat that ended in two sharply tailored points, "the gentleman's illness can be traced to the air in here, so it would be best and please him most if we simply skipped the infirmary and led him out of the law offices." "That's it," Kay cried out, so overjoyed he barely let the man finish his sentence. "I'm sure I'll feel better soon. I'm not that weak. I just need a little support under the arms. I won't be much trouble. It's not very far. Just take me to the door. I'll sit on the steps a bit and be fine soon. I never have attacks like this. It surprised me, too. After all, I'm an official myself, and I'm used to office air. But it does seem really bad in here. You say so yourself. Would you be so kind as to help me a little? I'm dizzy, and I feel sick when I stand on my own." And he lifted his shoulders to make it easier for the others to grab him under the arms. But the man didn't follow his suggestion. Instead, he kept his hands calmly in his pockets and laughed aloud. "You see," he said to the young woman, "I hit the nail on the head. It's only here that the gentleman feels unwell, not in general." The young woman smiled too, but she tapped the man lightly on the arm with her fingertips, as if he'd carried a joke with Kay too far. "Oh, don't worry," the man said, still laughing. "Of course I'll show the gentleman out." "All right, then," said the young woman, inclining her charming head for a moment. "Don't attach too much meaning to his laughter," the young woman said to Kay, who had lapsed into dejection again, staring vacantly and didn't seem in need of any explanation. "This gentleman, may I introduce you?" The man gave his permission with a wave of his hand. "This gentleman is our information officer. He provides waiting parties with any information they may need, and since our judicial system is not very well known among the general population, a great deal of information is requested. He has an answer for every question. You can try him out if you feel like it. But that's not his only asset. A second is his elegant dress. We, the staff, that is, decided that the information officer, who's always the first person the parties meet and the one they deal with most often, should be dressed elegantly to create a respectable first impression. The rest of us, sadly enough, are, as you can see in my own case, poorly dressed, in old-fashioned clothes. It doesn't make much sense to spend anything on clothing, since we're almost always in the offices, and even sleep here. But, as I said, in the information officer's case we thought fancy clothes were necessary. But since we couldn't get them from the administration, which is funny about that sort of thing, we took up a collection. The parties pitched in, too, and we bought him this handsome suit and a few others as well. So everything was set to make a good impression, but he ruins it by the way he laughs, which startles people." "So it does," the man said with an annoyed air. "But I don't understand, Fräulein, why you're telling this gentleman all our intimate secrets, or more accurately, forcing them upon him, since he has no interest in knowing them. Just look at him sitting there, obviously immersed in his own affairs." Kay didn't even feel like objecting. The young woman probably meant well. Perhaps she was trying to take his mind off things, or give him a chance to pull himself together, but she'd chosen the wrong method. "I had to explain why you laughed," the young woman said. "After all, it was insulting." "I think he'd forgive much worse insults if I would just show him the way out." Kay said nothing. He didn't even look up. He put up with the fact that the two were discussing him like a case. Indeed, he preferred it that way. But suddenly he felt the hand of the information officer on one arm and the hand of the young woman on the other. "Up with you now, you feeble fellow," said the information officer.
"Thank you both very much," said Kay, pleasantly surprised, rose slowly and guided the other's hands to the places where he most needed their support. "It seems like I'm overly concerned to place the information officer in a good light," the young woman said softly in Kay's ear as they approached the hallway. "But believe me, what I say is true. He's not hard-hearted. It's not his duty to accompany sick parties out, and yet he does, as you can see. Perhaps none of us is hard-hearted. Perhaps we'd all like to help. But as court officials, it can easily appear that we're hard-hearted and don't want to help anyone. That really bothers me."
"Wouldn't you like to sit here for a bit?" asked the information officer. They were already in the hallway, directly in front of the defendant Kay had spoken to earlier.
Kay was almost ashamed to face him. Earlier he had stood so erect before him, while now two people had to hold him up. The information officer balanced his hat on his outspread fingers, and his tousled hair fell across his sweat-covered brow. But the defendant seemed to notice none of this. He stood humbly before the information officer, who stared right past him, and merely attempted to excuse his presence.
"I realize there can't be any response to my petitions today," he said, "but I came anyway. I thought I could at least wait here, since it's Sunday, and I have plenty of time and won't disturb anyone."
"You don't have to be so apologetic about it," said the information officer. "Your concern is quite praiseworthy. Of course, you're taking up space unnecessarily, but as long as it doesn't begin to annoy me, I certainly won't hinder you from following the course of your affair in detail. Having seen others who scandalously neglect their duty, one learns to be patient with people like you. You may be seated."
"He really knows how to talk to the parties," whispered the young woman.
Kay nodded, but immediately flared up as the information officer asked him again, "Wouldn't you like to sit down here?"
"No," said Kay. "I don't want to rest."
He had said it as firmly as he could, but in reality it would have done him a great deal of good to sit down. He felt seasick. He thought he was on a ship rolling in heavy seas. It seemed to him that the waters were pounding against the wooden walls. There was a roar from the depths of the hallway, like the sound of breaking waves. The hallway seemed to pitch and roll, lifting and lowering the waiting clients on both sides. That made the calm demeanour of the young woman and man who led him even more incomprehensible. He was at their mercy. If they let go of him, he would fall like a plank. Sharp glances shot back and forth from their small eyes. Kay felt their steady tread without matching it, for he was practically carried along from step to step. He realized at last that they were speaking to him, but he couldn't understand them. He heard only the noise that filled everything, through which a steady, high-pitched sound like a siren seemed to emerge.
"Louder,"
he whispered with bowed head, and was ashamed, for he knew that they had spoken loudly enough, even though he hadn't understood. Then finally, as if the wall had split open before him, a draught of fresh air reached him, and he heard beside him, "First he wants to leave, then you can tell him 100 times that this is the exit, and he doesn't move." Kay saw that he was standing at the outer door, which the young woman had opened. Instantly, all his strength seemed to return. To get a foretaste of freedom, he stepped down immediately onto the first step, and from there took leave of his escorts, who bowed to him. "Thank you very much," he said again, shaking hands with both of them repeatedly, stopping only when he thought he noticed that they were unable to bear the comparatively fresh air from the stairway, accustomed as they were to the air in the offices of the court. They could hardly reply, and the young woman might have fallen had Kay not shut the door as quickly as possible. Kay stood quietly for a moment, smoothed his hair into place with the help of a pocket mirror, picked up his hat, which was lying on the landing below — the information officer must have tossed it there — and then raced down the steps with such long, energetic leaps that he was almost frightened by the sudden change. His normally sound constitution had never provided him with such surprises before. Was his body going to rebel and offer him a new trial, since he was handling the old one so easily? He didn't entirely rule out the thought of consulting a doctor at the first opportunity. In any case, and here he could advise himself, he would spend his Sunday mornings more profitably than this from now on. Chapter 5. The Flogger. A few evenings later, as Kay passed through the corridor that led from his office to the main staircase — he was almost the last to leave that night, only two assistants in shipping were still at work in the small circle of light from a single bulb — he heard the sound of groans behind a door that he had always assumed led to a mere junk room, though he had never seen it himself. He stopped in amazement and listened again to see if he might not be mistaken. It was quiet for a little while, but then the groans came again. At first, feeling he might need a witness, he was about to call one of the assistants, but then he was seized by such uncontrollable curiosity that he practically tore the door open. It was, as he had suspected, a junk room. Old, obsolete printed forms and overturned empty ceramic ink bottles lay beyond the threshold. In the little room itself, however, stood three men, stooping beneath the low ceiling. A candle stuck on a shelf provided light. "What's going on here?" Kay blurted out in his excitement, but not loudly. One man, who was apparently in charge of the others and drew Kay's attention first, was got up in some sort of dark leather garment that left his neck and upper chest, as well as his entire arms, bare. He didn't reply, but the other two cried out,
"Sir, we're about to be flogged because you complained about us to the examining magistrate." And only then did Kay recognize that it was indeed the guards, Franz and Willem, and that the third man held a rod in his hand to flog them with. "Well now," said Kay, staring at them, "I didn't complain. I just told them what went on in my lodgings. And your behavior wasn't exactly impeccable." "Sir," said Willem, while Franz apparently tried to seek safety behind him from the third man, "if you knew how poorly we're paid, you'd judge us more kindly. I have a family to feed, and Franz here wants to get married. You try to make money however you can. Just working isn't enough, no matter how hard you try. I was tempted by your fine undergarments. Guards are forbidden to act that way, of course. It was wrong. But it's a tradition that the undergarments belong to the guards. It's always been that way, believe me. And you can see why. What difference do such things make to a person unlucky enough to be arrested? If he makes it public, of course, then punishment must follow." "I didn't know any of that, and I certainly didn't demand your punishment. It was a matter of principle." "Franz," Willem turned to the other guard, "didn't I tell you the gentleman didn't demand our punishment? Now, as you hear, he didn't even realize we'd have to be punished."
"Don't be swayed by that sort of talk," the third man said to Kay. "Their punishment is as just as it is inevitable."
"Oh, don't listen to him," said Willem, interrupting himself only to lift a hand, across which he had received a blow of the rod, quickly to his mouth. "We're only being punished because you reported us. Otherwise nothing would have happened, even if they had found out what we had done. Do you call that justice? Both of us have proved ourselves as guards over a long period of time, especially me. You have to admit we did a good job from the authorities' point of view. We had prospects for advancement and would soon have been floggers ourselves, like him, who was simply fortunate enough never to have been reported by anyone, for such reports are really quite rare. And now everything is lost, sir. Our careers are finished. We'd have to work at a much lower level than a guard and undergo this terribly painful flogging as well."
"Can a rod cause that much pain?" Kay asked, and examined the rod, which the flogger swung before him.
"We have to strip completely," said Willem.
"Oh, I see," said Kay, looking more closely at the flogger, who had a sailor's tan and a savage, ruddy face.
"Is there any possibility of sparing these two a flogging?" he asked him.
"No," said the flogger, and shook his head with a smile.
"Strip,"
he ordered the guards. And to Kay he said,
"You mustn't believe everything they say. They're already a bit weak in the head because they're so afraid of the flogging. What this one was saying, for example," he pointed at Willem, "about his prospective career is totally ridiculous. Look how overweight he is. The first blows of the rod will be lost in fat. Do you know how he got so fat? He's in the habit of eating the breakfast of anyone who's arrested. Didn't he eat yours as well? Well, what did I tell you? But a man with a belly like that can never become a flogger. It's totally out of the question."
"Well, there are floggers like me," insisted Willem, who was just undoing his belt.
"No," said the flogger, stroking him across the neck with the rod in a way that made him twitch. "You shouldn't be listening. You should be stripping."
"I'll reward you well if you'll let them go," said Kay, taking out his wallet without looking at the flogger again, such matters being best conducted by both parties with lowered eyes.
"Then you'll probably report me, too," said the flogger, "and earn me a flogging as well. No thanks."
"Oh, be reasonable," said Kay. "If I'd wanted to have these two punished, I wouldn't be trying to buy them off. I could simply shut the door, close my eyes and ears, and head home. But I'm not doing that. Instead, I'm serious about getting them off. If I'd suspected they'd be punished, or even known they'd faced possible punishment, I would never have mentioned their names. Because I don't even consider them guilty. It's the organization that's guilty. It's the high officials who are guilty."
"That's right," cried the guards, and immediately received a blow across their now bare backs.
"If you had a high judge here beneath your rod," said Kay, pressing down the rod, which was about to rise again as he spoke, "I really wouldn't stop you from flailing away. On the contrary, I'd pay you extra to strengthen you in your good work."
"I believe what you say," said the flogger, "but I can't be bribed. I've been hired to flog, and flog I will."
The guard Franz, who had kept somewhat in the background up to that point, perhaps in hope of a favourable outcome based on Kay's intervention, now stepped to the door, dressed only in his trousers, fell to his knees, and, clinging to Kay's arm, whispered,
"If you can't manage to get us both off, please try to at least save me. Willem is older than me, less sensitive in every way, and he already received a minor flogging once a few years ago, but I've never been disgraced that way, and was only following the lead of Willem, who is my mentor in all things, good and bad. My poor bride is waiting for me below in front of the bank. I'm so terribly ashamed."
He dried his tear-stained face on Kay's jacket.
I'm not waiting any longer, said the flogger, seized the rod with both hands and laid into Franz, while Willem cowered in a corner and peeked over without daring to turn his head. The scream that Franz expelled rose steady and unchanging, scarcely human, as if it came from some tortured instrument. The whole corridor rang with it. The entire building would hear.
"Don't scream," cried Kay, unable to stop himself.
And as he looked intently in the direction from which the assistants would be coming, he pushed Franz. Not hard, but hard enough that the witless man fell to the floor and clawed convulsively about with his hands. He didn't escape the blows, however. The rod found him on the floor as well. As he writhed beneath it, its tip swung up and down steadily. And in the distance, an assistant had already appeared, and a few steps behind him a second one. Kay slammed the door quickly, stepped up to a nearby courtyard window, and opened it. The screams had ceased completely. To keep the assistants from coming nearer, he called out, "It's me."
"Good evening, sir,"
the call came back.
"Has anything happened?"
"No, no," Kay replied. "It's just a dog howling in the courtyard." When the assistant still didn't stir, he added, "You can go on with your work." And to avoid getting involved in a conversation with them, he leaned out the window. When he looked down the corridor again, a while later, they were gone. But now Kay remained at the window. He didn't dare go into the junk room, and he didn't want to go home, either. The small rectangular courtyard he looked down upon was lined with offices. All the windows were dark by now, only the highest ones catching a reflection of the moon. Kay peered down intently, trying to penetrate the darkness of a corner of the courtyard where several pushcarts had been shoved together. It tormented him that he had been unable to prevent the flogging, but it wasn't his fault. If Franz hadn't screamed, of course it must have hurt terribly, but at critical moments you have to control yourself. If he hadn't screamed, Kay could very probably have still found some way to convince the flogger. If the entire lowest level of the bureaucracy was made up of riffraff, why should the flogger, who had the most inhuman job of all, be an exception? Kay had also taken close note of the way his eyes gleamed at the sight of the banknote. He had obviously taken the flogging so seriously solely to raise the amount of the bribe. And Kay wouldn't have been stingy. He really wanted to get the guards off. Having already begun to fight corruption in the judicial system, it was only natural to take this approach as well. But the moment Franz started screaming, it was all over, of course. Kay couldn't permit the assistants, and perhaps all sorts of other people, to arrive and catch him negotiating with this bunch in the junk room. No one could really demand such a sacrifice of him. If he had intended one, it would almost have been simpler for Kay to strip and offer himself to the flogger in place of the guards. The flogger would hardly have accepted this substitution, however, since it would have been a grave dereliction of duty with nothing to gain, and no doubt a double dereliction, since surely no employee of the court had the right to harm him while his case was still in progress. Of course, there might be special instructions in this respect as well. In any case, Kay could not have done otherwise than slam the door, even though he had by no means escaped all danger by doing so even now. That he had shoved Franz at the end was unfortunate and could only be excused by his state of agitation. In the distance, he heard the steps of the assistants. In order not to attract their attention, he closed the window and walked toward the main staircase. He stopped for a moment at the door of the junk room and listened. Silence reigned. The man might have beaten the guards to death. After all, they were completely in his power. Kay reached toward the door handle, but then pulled back his hand. He couldn't help anyone now, and the assistants would be coming at any moment. He vowed to bring the subject up again, however, and in so far as it was within his power, to punish appropriately those who were truly guilty, the high officials, not one of whom had yet dared to show himself to him. As he descended the front steps of the bank, he took careful note of all the passers-by, but there was no young woman in sight, even in the distance, who might have been waiting for someone. Franz's claim that his bride was waiting for him thus proved to be a lie. Understandable, of course, intended solely to awaken greater pity. The next day, Kay still couldn't get the guards off his mind. He had difficulty concentrating on his work, and in order to finish up, he had to stay at the office slightly longer than he had the day before. As he passed by the junk room again on his way home, he opened the door as if by habit. What he saw, in place of the expected darkness, bewildered him completely. Everything was unchanged, just as he had found it the previous evening when he opened the door. The printed forms and ink bottles just beyond the threshold,
the flogger with the rod, the guard still completely clothed, the candle on the shelf, and the guards began to wail, crying out, "Sir!" Kay slammed the door shut at once and pounded his fists against it, as if to close it more tightly. Almost in tears he ran to the assistants, who were working quietly at the copying press, and paused in their work with astonishment. "Clear out that junk room once and for all," he cried. "We're drowning in filth." The assistants said they would be happy to do it the next day, and Kay nodded. He couldn't force them to do it this late in the evening, as he had at first intended. He sat down for a moment to keep the assistants around a while longer, shuffled through a few copies, trying to give the impression that he was checking them over, and then, since he realized the assistants wouldn't dare leave with him, he headed for home, tired and with his mind a blank.
Chapter 6. The Uncle. Lenny. One afternoon, it was just before the final mail pickup and Kay was very busy, Kay's Uncle Carl, a small landowner from the country, shoved his way between two assistants bringing in documents and entered the room. Kay felt less alarm at seeing him than he had some time ago imagining his arrival. His uncle was bound to come, Kay had been sure of that for over a month. Even back then he could picture him, slightly stooped, his Panama hat crushed in his left hand, his right hand already stretched out toward him from afar, thrusting it across the desk in reckless haste, knocking over everything in his way. His uncle was always in a hurry, for he was constantly driven by the unfortunate notion that he had to accomplish everything he'd set out to do within the single day to which his visits to the capital were always limited. Nor did he dare let slip any opportunity for conversation, business, or pleasure that might happen to arise. Kay, who was particularly indebted to him because he was his former guardian, had to assist him in every way and put him up for the night as well. He called him the Spectre from the Countryside. As soon as he'd said hello, he didn't have time to sit down in the armchair Kay offered him, he asked Kay for a brief private conference.
"It's necessary," he said, swallowing with difficulty. "It's necessary for my peace of mind."
Kay sent the assistants from the room at once, with instructions to admit no one.
"What's this I hear, Joseph?"
cried his uncle once they were alone, seating himself on the desk and stuffing various papers under him without looking at them to make himself more comfortable. Kay said nothing. He knew what was coming, but released suddenly from the strain of work as he was, he gave himself up first to a pleasant languor and gazed out the window toward the opposite side of the street, of which only a small triangular section could be seen from his chair, a stretch of empty wall between two window displays.
"Stop staring out the window," his uncle cried with uplifted arms. "For heaven's sake, Joseph, answer me. Is it true? Can it be true, then?"
"Dear uncle," said Kay, tearing himself out of his reverie, "I have no idea what you're talking about."
"Joseph," said his uncle warningly, "to the best of my knowledge, you've always told the truth. Should I take your last words as a bad sign?"
"I can guess what you want," said Kay, submissively. "You've probably heard about my trial."
"That's right," said his uncle, nodding slowly. "I've heard about your trial."
"From whom?" Kay asked.
"Erno wrote to me about it," said his uncle. "She doesn't see anything of you, of course. You don't take any real interest in her, sadly enough, but she found out about it anyway. I received her letter today, and of course came here immediately. For no other reason, since this seemed reason enough. I can read you the passage that concerns you." He pulled the letter from his wallet. "Here it is," she writes. "It's been a long time since I've seen Joseph. I was in the bank once last week, but Joseph was so busy I couldn't see him. I waited for over an hour, but then I had to return home for my piano lesson. I would have liked to have talked to him. Maybe I'll get a chance, too, before long. He sent me a big box of chocolates on my name day. It was very sweet and thoughtful. I forgot to write to you about it earlier, and only remembered when you asked me. As I'm sure you know, chocolate disappears instantly at the boarding house. You hardly realize you've been given chocolates, and they're gone. But regarding Joseph, there's something else I wanted to tell you. As I mentioned, I couldn't get in to see him because he was busy with a gentleman. After I'd waited patiently for a while, I asked an assistant whether the appointment would last much longer. He said that it might, since it probably had something to do with the trial the chief financial officer was involved in. I asked what sort of a trial it was, whether he might be mistaken. But he said it was no mistake, it was a trial and a serious one at that, but that's all he knew. He said he'd like to help the chief financial officer himself, because he was a good and honest man, but he didn't know how to go about it, and he could only hope that influential people would intervene in his behalf. He thought that would surely happen and that things would turn out well, but for the moment, as he gathered from the chief financial officer's mood, things didn't look at all good. I didn't attach much importance to his words, of course, and tried to calm the simple-minded fellow, telling him not to mention it to anyone else, and I'm sure the whole thing is just idle talk. Nevertheless, it might be a good idea if you, dear father, looked into the matter the next time you're here. You could easily find out more about it, and, if truly necessary, intervene through your wide circle of influential friends. If, as is most likely, that doesn't prove necessary, it will at least give your daughter an opportunity to embrace you soon, which would give her great joy. A good child, his uncle said as he finished reading the letter, wiping a few tears from his eyes. Kay nodded. He had completely forgotten Erna due to the various recent disturbances, had even forgotten her birthday, and the story of the chocolates had obviously been invented merely to cover for him with his aunt and uncle. It was very touching, and the theatre tickets he now meant to send her on a regular basis would hardly make up for it, but right now he didn't feel up to visits at her boarding house and chats with a 17-year-old high school girl. "And now, what do you have to say?" asked his uncle, who, because of the letter, had temporarily forgotten his haste and agitation and was apparently reading it through once again. "Yes, uncle," said Kay. "It's true."
"True?" his uncle cried out. "What's true? How can it be true? What kind of a trial? Surely not a criminal trial?"
"A criminal trial," Kay replied.
"And you sit there calmly with a criminal trial hanging over your head?" cried his uncle, who kept getting louder.
"The calmer I am, the better, as far as the outcome is concerned," Kay said wearily. "Don't worry."
"Well, that scarcely sets my mind at rest," cried his uncle. "Joseph, dear Joseph, think of yourself, think of your relatives, of our good name. You've always been our pride and joy. You mustn't disgrace us now. Your attitude," he looked at Kay, with his head sharply cocked, "doesn't please me at all. That's not how an innocent man acts who still has his strength. Just tell me quickly what it's all about, so I can help you. Something with the bank, of course."
"No," said Kay, standing up. "But you're talking too loudly, dear uncle. The assistant's probably eavesdropping at the door. I don't like that. We should go somewhere else. Then I'll answer all your questions as best I can. I'm well aware that I owe the family an explanation."
"Right," his uncle burst out. "Quite right. But hurry, Joseph, hurry."
"I still have a few instructions to give," said Kay, and summoned his administrative deputy by phone, who entered a few moments later. His uncle, still agitated, gestured toward Kay to show that he was the one who had called, which was clear enough anyway. Kay, standing before his desk, went through various papers, explaining quietly to the young man, who listened calmly but attentively, what still needed to be done that day in his absence. His uncle disturbed him by standing there biting his lips and staring wide-eyed, without listening, of course, but just his presence was disturbing enough. Then he started pacing back and forth in the room, pausing now and then by the window or at a picture and breaking out with,
"I just don't understand it," or, "What in the world's to come of all this?"
The young man acted as if he didn't notice a thing, listened calmly until Kay had finished his instructions, took a few notes, and departed, after bowing to both Kay and his uncle, who, however, had turned his back to him to stare out the window, clutching the curtains in his outstretched hands. The door had barely closed when his uncle burst out,
"At last that jumping jack is gone. Now we can leave too. Finally."
Out in the lobby, unfortunately, there was no way he could get his uncle to stop asking questions about the trial, although several assistants and officers were standing about, and the vice president himself was just passing by.
"Now, Joseph,"
his uncle began, responding to the bows of the people standing about with a brief salute.
"Now tell me frankly what sort of trial this is."
Kay made a few non-committal remarks, gave a laugh or two, and only when he was on the steps did he explain to his uncle that he hadn't wanted to speak openly in front of other people.
"Right," said his uncle. "But now talk."
He listened with bowed head, taking short, hasty puffs on his cigar. "First of all, uncle," said Kay, "it's not a trial before the normal court."
"Well, that's bad," his uncle said.
"I beg your pardon?" said Kay, and looked at his uncle.
"I said that's bad," his uncle repeated.
They were standing on the front steps leading to the street. Since the doorman seemed to be listening, Kay drew his uncle down the stairs. The busy traffic on the street enveloped them. The uncle, who had taken Kay's arm, no longer inquired about the trial so insistently, and they even walked along for a while in silence.
"But how did it happen?"
his uncle finally asked, stopping so suddenly that the people walking behind him were startled and had to step to the side.
"Well, these things don't happen all at once. They build up over a long period of time. There must have been some indications. Why didn't you write to me? You know I'll do anything for you. I'm still your guardian, in a sense, and until today I've been proud of it. Of course, I'll still help you, but it's going to be very difficult now that the trial is already underway. In any case, it would be best for you to take a brief vacation and visit us in the countryside. You've lost some weight, too. I can see it now. You'll regain your strength in the country, which is a good thing, since this is obviously going to require a good deal of effort, and you'll be placed beyond the reach of the court somewhat. Here they have all sorts of instruments of power, and they will necessarily automatically use them against you. But in the country they would first have to delegate agents, or try to get at you entirely by letter, or by telegraph, or by telephone. Naturally that weakens the effect. It doesn't free you, of course, but it gives you some breathing room.
They might forbid me to leave, said Kay, who was starting to be drawn in by his uncle's line of thought.
I don't think they'll do that, his uncle said pensively. They wouldn't lose that much power if you left town.
I thought, said Kay, taking his uncle by the arm to keep him from stopping again, that you would attach even less importance to the whole matter than I did, and now you're taking it so hard.
Joseph,
his uncle cried, trying to twist away from him so he could pause, which Kay prevented.
You've undergone a total metamorphosis. You've always had such a keen grasp of things. Has it deserted you now, of all times? Do you want to lose this trial? Do you know what that means? It means you'll simply be crossed off, and that all your relatives will be drawn in, or at least dragged through the mud. Pull yourself together, Joseph. Your indifference is driving me crazy. Looking at you almost makes me believe the old saying, trials like that are lost from the start.
Dear uncle, said Kay, there's no use getting excited. It won't help either of us. Trials aren't won by getting excited. Let my practical experience count for something, just as I've always valued yours, and still do, even when I'm surprised by it. Since you say that the family will suffer too because of the trial, which for my part I really can't understand, but that's beside the point, I'll gladly do as you say in all things, except that I don't think a stay in the country would be to my advantage, even in the sense you intend, because it would imply flight and a guilty conscience. And although they certainly follow me more closely here, I can also take a more active role in the case.
Right, said his uncle, as if they were at last on the same track. I only made that suggestion because I was afraid if you remained here your case would be damaged by your own indifference, and I thought it better to act in your behalf. But if you intend to pursue it as strongly as possible yourself, that's obviously far better.
So we seem to be in agreement on that, said Kay. And now, do you have a suggestion as to what I should do next?
I still have to think the matter over, of course, his uncle said. You've got to remember that I've spent the past 20 years almost exclusively in the countryside, where one tends to lose the flair for this sort of thing. Various important connections with well-placed persons who might know more about such matters have weakened over time. I've been somewhat isolated in the countryside, as you well know. That's something you don't really realize yourself until something like this comes up. And your case has caught me partly by surprise, although in a strange way I suspected something like this after Anna's letter, and knew almost for certain the moment I saw you today. But that's beside the point. The important thing now is not to lose any time.
Even as he was speaking, he rose up on tiptoe and waved for a cab. And now he pulled Kay after him into the car as he called out an address to the driver.
Now we're going to see Hold the lawyer, he said. He was my classmate in school. You know the name, of course. No? Well, that's odd. He has a considerable reputation as a defense counsel and poor man's lawyer. But it's his human qualities I place my trust in.
"Anything you want to do is fine with me," Kay said, in spite of the fact that the hasty and aggressive manner with which his uncle was handling the matter made him uncomfortable. As a defendant, it wasn't very pleasant to be heading for a poor man's lawyer. "I didn't know," he said, "that a person could engage a lawyer in this sort of case, too."
"Well, but of course," his uncle said. "That goes without saying. Why not? And now, tell me everything that's happened up to now, so I'm fully informed about the matter."
Kay began telling him immediately, without concealing anything. His total frankness was the only protest he could allow himself against his uncle's opinion that the trial was a terrible disgrace. He mentioned Fraulein Borstner's name only once in passing, but that didn't detract from his frankness, since Fraulein Borstner wasn't connected with the trial in any way. As he spoke, he looked out the window and noticed that they were approaching the very suburb where the law court offices were located. He pointed this out to his uncle, who, however, did not find the coincidence particularly striking. The cab stopped in front of a dark building. His uncle rang the bell at the first door on the ground floor. While they waited, he bared his large teeth in a smile and whispered,
8 o'clock. An unusual hour for a client to visit, but Hold won't hold it against me.
At a peephole in the door appeared two large dark eyes, stared at the two visitors for a moment, then disappeared. The door, however, did not open. Kay and his uncle mutually confirmed the fact that they had seen two eyes.
"A new maid who's afraid of strangers," his uncle said, and knocked again.
Once more the eyes appeared. They could almost be considered sad now, but that might well have been a mere illusion produced by the open gas flame that burned with a hiss directly over their heads, but shed little light.
"Open up," his uncle called out, and pounded his fist against the door. "We're friends of Herr Huld."
"Herr Huld is ill," came a whisper from behind them.
In a doorway at the other end of the narrow hall stood a man in a dressing gown who delivered this message in the softest voice possible. His uncle, who was already furious at the long wait, turned around abruptly and cried out,
"Ill? You say he's ill?"
and walked over to him almost menacingly, as if the man were the illness.
"The door's open now,"
the man said, pointed to the lawyer's door, gathered up his dressing gown and disappeared. The door had indeed opened, and a young girl, Kay recognized the dark, slightly protruding eyes, was standing in a long white apron in the entranceway, holding a candle in her hand.
"Next time, open more quickly,"
his uncle said instead of a greeting, while the girl made a small curtsy.
"Come on, Joseph,"
he said to Kay, who made his way slowly past the girl.
"Herr Huld is ill,"
said the girl, since Kay's uncle was hurrying toward the door without pausing. Kay was still staring at the girl as she turned around to relock the apartment door. She had a round, doll-like face, her pale cheeks and chin forming a circle completed by her temples and forehead.
"Joseph," his uncle cried again, and asked the girl, "is it his heart condition?"
"I think so,"
said the girl, who had found time to precede them with the candle and open the door. In a corner of the room the candlelight did not yet reach, a face with a long beard rose in the bed.
"Lenny, who is it?"
asked the lawyer, who, blinded by the candle, did not yet recognize the guests.
"It's your old friend Albert,"
his uncle said.
"Oh, Albert,"
said the lawyer, and fell back upon the pillows, as if he didn't have to pretend for this visit.
"Are things really so bad?"
asked his uncle, and sat down on the edge of the bed.
"I don't believe it. It's just your heart acting up again. It will pass as it has before."
"Possibly," the lawyer said softly. "But it's worse than it's ever been. I have a hard time breathing. I can't sleep at all, and I'm getting weaker every day."
"I see,"
said Kay's uncle, and pressed his Panama hat firmly down on his knee with his large hand.
"That's bad news. Are you sure you're receiving proper care? So dark and gloomy here, too. It's been a long time since I was here, but it seemed more cheerful in the past. And this little maid of yours doesn't seem very jolly, or else she's hiding it."
The girl was still standing by the door, holding the candle. As far as one could judge from her vague gaze, she was looking at Kay rather than his uncle, even now that the latter was talking about her. Kay was leaning against the chair he had placed near the girl.
"When you're as sick as I am," said the lawyer, "you need peace and quiet. I don't find it gloomy."
After a brief pause, he added,
"And Lenny takes good care of me. She's a good girl."
But that didn't convince Kay's uncle. He was obviously prejudiced against the nurse, and although he didn't contradict the sick man, he eyed her sternly as she now approached the bed, placed the candle on the nightstand, bent over the sick man, and whispered to him as she straightened his pillows. Almost forgetting his consideration for the sick man, he stood up and paced back and forth behind the nurse, and Kay would not have been surprised to see him seize her from behind by the skirts and pull her away from the bed. Kay himself watched all this calmly. In fact, the lawyer's illness was not wholly unwelcome, for he had not been able to stem his uncle's zeal with regard to his case, and now he was glad to see that zeal deflected through no fault of his own. Then, perhaps merely intending to wound the nurse, his uncle said,
"Young lady, please leave us alone for a while. I have a personal matter I wish to discuss with my friend."
The nurse, who was still leaning across the sick man and was just smoothing the covers next to the wall, merely turned her head and said calmly, in striking contrast to his uncle, who had first choked with rage before bursting out in speech,
"You can see he's too ill to discuss any personal matter."
She'd probably repeated his uncle's words for simplicity's sake. Nevertheless, even a neutral observer could have taken it for mockery, and his uncle naturally reacted as if he'd been stabbed.
"You damned,"
he said somewhat indistinctly in his first gurgle of agitation. Kay was startled, even though he'd expected something of the sort, and ran over to his uncle, firmly intending to cover his mouth with both hands. Fortunately, however, the sick man rose up behind the girl. Kay's uncle made a bitter face, as if he were swallowing something particularly nasty, and then said more calmly,
"We haven't taken leave of our senses, of course. If what I'm requesting weren't reasonable, I wouldn't request it. Now, please leave."
The nurse stood beside the bed, facing Kay's uncle fully, one hand, as Kay thought he noticed, stroking the lawyer's hand.
"You can say anything in front of Lenny," the sick man said, in a clearly imploring tone. "But this doesn't concern me," said Kay's uncle. "It is not my secret."
And he turned around as if he had no intention of discussing the matter further, but would give him a little more time to think it over.
"Whom does it concern, then?" the lawyer asked,
his voice fading, and lay back down.
"My nephew," said the uncle, "and I brought him along."
Then he introduced him.
"Chief Financial Officer Joseph Kay."
"Oh," said the sick man much more energetically, and put out his hand toward Kay.
"Please excuse me, I didn't see you at all." "Go on, Lenny," he then said to his nurse,
who put up no further resistance, and gave her his hand as if they were parting for some time.
"So,"
he said at last to Kay's uncle, who had also drawn nearer, appeased,
"you didn't come to pay a sick call, you came on business."
It was as if this image of a sick call had paralyzed the lawyer up till then, so rejuvenated did he now appear, propping himself up on one elbow, which must have been something of a strain in itself, and repeatedly tugging at a strand in the middle of his beard.
"You look much better already," Kay's uncle said, "now that that witch is gone."
He broke off, whispered,
"I'll bet she's eavesdropping," and sprang to the door.
But there was no one behind the door. His uncle returned, not in disappointment, for her not listening struck him as an even greater act of malice, but no doubt embittered.
"You misjudge her,"
said the lawyer, without defending her further. Perhaps he wished to show by this that she needed no defence. But he continued in a much more engaged tone.
"As far as the matter with your nephew is concerned, I would, of course, count myself fortunate if my strength were equal to this most difficult of tasks. I greatly fear it won't be, but I'll certainly try everything I possibly can. If I'm not equal to the task, someone else can be brought in as well. To be honest, the affair interests me far too much for me to give up being involved in some way. If my heart can't take it, it will at least offer a worthy occasion for it to fail entirely."
Kay felt he hadn't understood a word of this entire speech. He looked at his uncle, seeking some explanation there, but he was sitting with the candle in his hand on the little nightstand, from which a medicine bottle had already rolled onto the carpet, nodding at everything the lawyer said, agreeing with everything, and glancing at Kay now and then, urging the same assent from him. Had his uncle perhaps already informed the lawyer about his trial? But that was impossible. Everything up to now spoke against it. So he said,
"I don't understand." "Oh, have I perhaps misunderstood you?"
asked the lawyer, as surprised and embarrassed as Kay.
"Perhaps I spoke too soon. What was it you wanted to talk to me about, then? I thought it concerned your trial." "Of course," said Kay's uncle, and then asked Kay, "What's bothering you?"
"Well, yes, but how do you know about me and my trial?" asked Kay.
"Oh, I see," said the lawyer with a smile. "I'm a lawyer, after all. I move in legal circles. Various trials are discussed, and the more striking ones stick in one's memory, particularly when they concern the nephew of a friend. There's nothing unusual in that." "What's bothering you?" the uncle asked Kay again. "You're so agitated."
"You move in those legal circles?" Kay asked.
"Yes," said the lawyer. "You're asking questions like a child," said his uncle. "With whom should I associate if not my professional colleagues?" the lawyer added.
It sounded so irrefutable that Kay didn't even answer. "But you work at the court in the Palace of Justice, not at the one in the attic," was what he wanted to say. But he couldn't bring himself to actually do so.
"You must consider the fact," the lawyer continued in a perfunctory tone, as if explaining something self-evident, superfluously and merely in passing. "You must consider the fact that such associations offer major advantages for my clients. In many respects, one can't always even discuss them. Of course, I'm a bit hampered now by my illness, but I'm still visited by good friends from court and learn a few things, more perhaps than some people in perfect health who spend all day at court. For example, I have a special visitor at this very moment."
And he pointed into a dark corner of the room.
"Where?"
Kay demanded almost rudely in his initial surprise. He looked around uncertainly. The light of the little candle fell far short of the opposite wall, and indeed something began to stir there in the corner.
In the light of the candle his uncle now held high, an older gentleman could be seen by a little table. He must not have even been breathing to have remained unnoticed for so long. Now he arose laboriously, apparently displeased that he had been brought to their attention. It seemed as if he wanted to wave off all greetings and introductions with his hands, which he flapped like small wings, as if he wished under no circumstances to disturb the others by his presence, imploring them to return him once more to darkness, to forget his presence. But that could no longer be granted.
"You caught us by surprise, you see," the lawyer said by way of explanation, waving encouragingly to the gentleman to draw nearer, which he did, slowly, looking about hesitantly, and yet with a certain dignity.
"Here's the chief clerk of the court. Oh, I beg your pardon, I haven't introduced you. This is my friend Albert Kay, his nephew, Chief Financial Officer Joseph Kay, and this is the chief clerk of the court. The chief clerk was kind enough to pay me a visit. Only an insider who knows how overburdened the chief clerk is with work can fully appreciate the value of such a visit. Yet even so he came, and we were conversing quietly, as far as my weakened state allows. We hadn't forbidden Lenny to admit visitors, for none were expected, but we certainly thought we'd be left to ourselves. But then came the blows of your fist on the door, Albert, and the chief clerk moved into the corner with his table and chair, although it now turns out that we may have a common matter to discuss, that is, if you want to, and we may just as well sit back down together. Please, my dear sir," he said with bowed head and a subservient smile, pointing to an armchair near the bed. "Well, unfortunately, I can only stay a few minutes longer," the chief clerk of the court said amiably, settling comfortably into the armchair and looking at the clock. "Duty calls. In any case, I don't want to miss the opportunity to meet a friend of my friend." He bowed slightly toward Kay's uncle, who seemed quite pleased by this new acquaintance, but being by nature incapable of expressions of humble respect, responded to the chief clerk's words with a loud and embarrassed laugh. An ugly sight. Kay could observe everything at his leisure, for no one paid any attention to him. The chief clerk, now that he had been drawn forth, took the lead in the conversation, as seemed to be his custom. The lawyer, whose initial weakness may have been intended simply to cut short the new visit, listened attentively, his hand at his ear. Kay's uncle, the candle-bearer, he balanced the candle on one thigh, the lawyer kept looking over anxiously, had soon overcome his embarrassment and was now simply delighted, both by the chief clerk's words and by the gentle, undulating gestures with which he accompanied them. Kay, who was leaning against the bedpost, was totally ignored by the chief clerk, perhaps even intentionally, and functioned merely as an auditor for the old men. Moreover, he scarcely knew what they were talking about, and was thinking instead one moment about the nurse and how his uncle had mistreated her, and the next whether he hadn't seen the chief clerk somewhere before, perhaps even among the crowd during his initial hearing. Even if he was mistaken, the chief clerk of the court would certainly have fit perfectly into the front row of the assembly, those old men with their scraggly beards. Then a sound like breaking china came from the hall, causing them all to prick up their ears. "I'll go see what's happened," said Kay, and walked out slowly, as if he was giving the others a chance to stop him. He had barely stepped into the hall and was trying to find his way about in the dark, when a small hand, much smaller than Kay's, placed itself upon the hand he still held against the door and closed it softly. It was the nurse who had been waiting there.
"It was nothing," she whispered. "I just threw a plate against the wall to get you to come out."
In his embarrassment, Kay said, "I was thinking about you, too."
"All the better," said the nurse. "Come on."
After a few steps, they came to a door with frosted glass, which the nurse opened before Kay.
"Go on in,"
she said. It must have been the lawyer's study, as far as could be seen in the moonlight, which now brightly illuminated only a small rectangle of the floor by each of the two large windows. It was furnished with old, heavy furniture.
"This way,"
said the nurse, and pointed toward a dark bench chest with a carved wooden back. Even as he was sitting down, Kay looked around the room. It was a large and lofty room. The clients of the poor man's lawyer must have felt lost in it. Kay felt he could picture the tiny steps with which the visitors approached the massive desk. But then he forgot about that and had eyes only for the nurse, who was sitting right beside him, almost pressing him against the arm of the bench.
"I thought you would have come to me on your own," she said, "without my having to call you first. It was strange. First you stared at me from the moment you entered, and then you kept me waiting. By the way, call me Lenny," she added abruptly, as if not a moment of their talk should be wasted.
"Gladly," said Kay, "but it's easy enough to explain what you found so strange, Lenny.
First, I had to listen to the idle talk of those old men and couldn't walk out without a reason. Second, I'm not very forward. I'm more on the shy side, and you, Lenny, didn't really look like you could be had for the asking.
That's not it,
said Lenny, laying her arm along the back of the bench and looking at Kay.
I didn't please you, and probably still don't.
Please isn't the half of it, Kay said evasively.
Ooh,
she said with a smile, and through Kay's remark and her little cry gained a certain advantage. So Kay remained silent for a while. Since he had already grown accustomed to the darkness of the room, he could make out various details of the furnishings. He noticed in particular a large painting hanging to the right of the door and leaned forward to see it better. It showed a man in a judge's robe. He was sitting on a throne, its golden highlights gleaming forth from the painting in several places. The strange thing was that this judge wasn't sitting in calm dignity, but instead had his left arm braced against the back and arm of the chair, while his right arm was completely free, his hand alone clutching the arm of the chair, as if he were about to spring up any moment in a violent and perhaps wrathful outburst to say something decisive or even pass judgment. The defendant was probably to be thought of as at the foot of the stairs, the upper steps of which, covered with a yellow carpet, could be seen in the picture. "Perhaps that's my judge," said Kay, and pointed to the picture.
"I know him,"
said Lenny, looking up at the picture as well.
"He comes here often. That's a portrait of him when he was young, but he surely never looked like that. He's so small, he's almost tiny. Even so, he had himself stretched out that way in the painting, since he's ridiculously vain, like everyone here. But I'm vain, too, and very unhappy that I don't please you."
Kay responded to this last remark simply by putting his arm around Lenny and drawing her to him. She leaned her head quietly against his shoulder. But to the rest he said only, "What's his rank?"
"He's an examining magistrate,"
she said, taking the hand Kay had around her and playing with his fingers. "Just another examining magistrate," Kay said in disappointment. "The higher judges stay in hiding. But yet he's sitting on a throne."
"That's all invention,"
said Lenny, her head bent over Kay's hand.
"He's actually sitting on a kitchen stool with an old horse blanket folded over it. But is your trial all you think about?" she added slowly.
"No, not at all," said Kay. "I probably think too little about it."
"That's not the mistake you make," said Lenny. "You're too stubborn, the way I hear it."
"Who said that?" asked Kay. He felt her body against his chest and looked down at her thick, dark, tightly rolled hair.
"I'd reveal too much if I told you," Lenny responded. "Please don't ask for names, but stop making that mistake. Don't be so stubborn. You can't defend yourself against this court. All you can do is confess. Confess the first chance you get. That's the only chance you have to escape, the only one. However, even that is impossible without help from others, but you needn't worry about that. I'll help you myself."
"You know a lot about this court and the deceit it makes necessary," said Kay, lifting her up onto his lap, since she was pressing against him all too insistently.
"This is nice,"
she said, and arranged herself in his lap, smoothing her skirt and straightening her blouse. Then she put both her arms around his neck, leaned back, and took a long look at him. "And if I don't confess, you can't help me?" Kay asked, tentatively. "I recruit women helpers," he thought, almost amazed. "First Fraulein Borstner, then the court usher's wife, and now this little nurse, who seems to have an inexplicable desire for me. The way she's sitting on my lap as if it were the only proper place for her."
"No,"
Lenny replied, shaking her head slowly.
"Then I can't help you." "But you don't want my help. You don't care about it. You're stubborn and refuse to be convinced." "Do you have a sweetheart?"
she asked, after a moment.
"No," said Kay.
"Oh, surely you must,"
she said.
"Well, in fact, I do," said Kay. "Just think, I denied her existence, and yet I even carry her picture with me."
At her request, he showed her a photograph of Elsa. Curled in his lap, she studied the picture. It was a snapshot. Elsa was caught at the end of a whirling dance of the sort she enjoyed performing at the tavern, her dress still swirling about her, her hands on her hips, looking off to the side and laughing, her throat taut. The person at whom her laughter was directed couldn't be seen in the picture.
"She's very tightly laced," said Lenny, and pointed to the spot where, in her opinion, this was evident. "I don't like her. She's clumsy and rough. But perhaps she's kind and gentle with you. You could gather that from looking at the picture. Big, strong girls like that often don't know how to be anything but kind and gentle. But would she sacrifice herself for you?"
"No," Kay said.
She's neither kind and gentle, nor would she sacrifice herself for me. But so far I haven't demanded either of her. I've never even examined the picture as closely as you have."
"So you don't care that much about her," said Lenny. "She's not really your sweetheart."
"Oh, yes," said Kay. "I won't take back what I said."
"Well, she may be your sweetheart now," said Lenny, "but you wouldn't miss her much if you lost her, or traded her for someone else. Me, for example."
"Of course," said Kay with a smile, "that's conceivable. But she has one major advantage over you. She doesn't know anything about my trial, and even if she did, she wouldn't think about it. She wouldn't try to talk me into giving in."
"That's no advantage," said Lenny. "If that's her only advantage, I won't lose heart. Does she have a physical defect of any sort?"
"A physical defect?" asked Kay.
"Yes," said Lenny. "I have a slight defect of that sort. Look."
She spread apart the middle and ring fingers of her right hand, between which the connecting skin extended almost to the top knuckle of her short fingers. In the darkness, Kay couldn't see at first what it was she wanted to show him, so she guided his hand to feel it. "What a whim of nature," Kay said, and added, when he had examined her whole hand, "What a pretty claw." Lenny watched with a kind of pride as Kay opened and closed her two fingers repeatedly in astonishment until he finally kissed them lightly and released them.
"Oh," she cried out at once, "you've kissed me."
Hastily, with open mouth, she climbed up his lap on her knees. Kay looked up at her in near dismay. Now that she was so close to him, an exciting, almost bitter odor, like pepper, rose from her. She pulled his head to her and bent over it, biting and kissing his neck, even biting his hair.
"You've traded her for me," she cried from time to time. "You see, now you've traded her for me after all."
Then her knees slid from under her, and with a small cry she almost slipped to the carpet. Kay put his arms around her to catch her and was drawn down with her.
"Now you belong to me," she said.
"Here's the key to the building. Come whenever you like,"
were her last words, and a nameless kiss struck him on the back while he was still on his way out. As he stepped out the door, a light rain was falling. He was about to walk out into the middle of the street on the chance he might still see Lenny at the window, when, from a car Kay hadn't noticed waiting in front of the building, his uncle suddenly emerged, grabbed him by the arms, and shoved him against the door of the building, as if to nail him fast to it.
"My boy," he cried, "how could you do it? You've damaged your case terribly when it was starting out so well. You crawl off to hide with a dirty little creature who obviously happens to be the lawyer's mistress and stay away for hours. You don't even look for an excuse, make no effort to cover it up. No, you're totally open about it. Run to her and stay with her. And meanwhile we're sitting there, the uncle who's working hard on your behalf, the lawyer who's to be won over for you, and most important of all, the chief clerk of the court, this noteworthy gentleman who is practically in charge of your case in its present stage. We're trying to figure out the best way to help you. I have to handle the lawyer carefully, he has to handle the chief clerk the same way, and you have every reason to at least offer me support. Instead, you stay away. In the end, there's no way to conceal it. Now, these are polite, sophisticated men. They don't say anything, they try to spare me, but in the end, even they can't bring themselves to go on. And since they can't talk about the case, they fall silent. We sat there for several minutes without saying anything, listening to see if you might be returning at last after all. All in vain. Finally, the chief clerk, who has remained much longer than he originally intended to, stands up, takes his leave, obviously sorry for me but unable to help, waits with incredible kindness a bit longer at the door, then leaves. Of course, I was happy he was gone. I'd reached the point where I was having trouble even breathing. All this had an even stronger effect on the ailing lawyer. The good man couldn't even speak as I took my leave. You've probably contributed to his total collapse, thus hastening the death of a man you're dependent upon. And you leave me, your uncle, waiting here in the rain for hours. Just feel. I'm soaked, clear through."
Chapter 7. Lawyer. Manufacturer. Painter. On a winter morning, outside snow was falling in the dull light, Kay was sitting in his office, already thoroughly fatigued in spite of the early hour. To shield himself from at least minor staff members, he had given instructions to his assistant not to let any of them in, since he was working on an important project. But instead of working, he swung about in his chair, moved a few items around slowly on his desk, and then, without being aware of it, left his arm outstretched on the desktop and remained sitting motionless with bowed head. The thought of his trial never left him now.
He had often considered whether it might not be advisable to prepare a written defense and submit it to the court. In it he would offer a brief overview of his life, and for each event of any particular importance explain why he had acted as he did, whether in his present judgment this court of action deserved approval or censure, and what reasons he could advance for the one or the other. The advantages of such a written defense over simply leaving things in the hands of his lawyer, who was far from perfect anyway, were obvious. After all, Kay had no idea what action his lawyer was taking. In any case, it wasn't much. It had been over a month now since he'd summoned him, nor had any of these earlier consultations given Kay the impression the man would be able to do much for him. In the first place, he scarcely asked any questions, and yet there was so much to ask. Questions were the main thing. Kay had the feeling he could ask all the necessary questions on his own. His lawyer, on the other hand, instead of asking questions, did all the talking, or sat across from him in silence, leaning slightly forward over the desk, probably because of his poor hearing, tugging at a strand in the middle of his beard and looking down at the carpet, perhaps at the very spot where Kay had lain with Lenny. Now and then he gave Kay a few empty admonitions, as if talking to a child. Speeches as useless as they were boring, for which Kay had no intention of paying one red cent in the final billing. When the lawyer seemed to feel he had humbled him adequately, he usually began to cheer him up a little again. He would tell him how he had already won, or come close to winning, many similar trials, trials which, if not quite so difficult in reality as his, appeared even more hopeless on the surface. He had a list of those trials right there in his drawer. With this he tapped some compartment or other in his desk. Unfortunately, he couldn't show him the documents, since they were officially secret. Nevertheless, the extensive experience he had gained in all these trials would naturally be used to Kay's benefit. He had, of course, set to work immediately, and the first petition was already nearly finished. It was very important, for the first impression made by the defense often influenced the whole course of the proceedings. Unfortunately, and he felt he must point this out to Kay, on some occasions initial petitions were not even read by the court. They were simply put in the file with a note that, for the time being, the hearings and surveillance of the accused were much more important than anything put in writing.
This book is continued on Disc 4.